Hey guys, it's Lavetta.
And it's Miriam.
And this is the Notorious Women Podcast, a comedy podcast about some of history's most notorious women.
Some of these queens are heroic.
And some of these bitches are horrific. But we think the most interesting thing of all is that they're all
notorious.
Yes!
Welcome back.
Welcome back, everyone. We hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving. Now that that's over, now we have to maybe fast for the Christmas feast, Hanukkah.
Oh, right.
You know, holiday Kwanzaa.
When is Kwanzaa coming up?
Kwanzaa, do you know? I think Kwanzaa begins after Christmas. So it's like, I could be wrong. And we didn't really celebrate Kwanzaa when I was coming up, but.
Yeah.
And I know it's a fairly newer
holiday. I was going to say, it was probably, I'm not trying to age you, but it probably started after you were really little, even though you're only 25.
Yeah. So, even though, like, God, I do not want to be 25 again.
That was rough. That was
terrible.
Yeah, it was, right?
But we want to also give a shout out to our Jewish friends for Happy Hanukkah, our Muslim friends. But Muslims celebrate Christmas. So we're just
saying hi to our Muslim friends. Hi, guys.
Yes. Hi, guys.
Enjoy the pretty lights.
Yeah. And I mean, snowman, like candy.
Right? It's
like, you know.
Festive, warm fires.
Pumpkin spice. You know, pumpkin. You know. I love a pumpkin loaf cake. I love pumpkin.
Oh my God. My children.
So good.
Are obsessed. And this is problematic because last year around October, I said, yes, every time we go to, it rhymes with Arbucks. and if they want to sponsor us, I'll add in the ST. I was like, okay, for this month and like November, we'll get it. Turns out it's a year-round food. I didn't know that.
I love it. But I only crave it during the holidays.
Right.
Because it's in the air. The smell is in the air and like
exactly.
And cinnamon. Do you ever get the pine cones that are like scented with cinnamon?
Yes, I do. I do
so
that.
So good.
I put it in my house.
Oh, yeah. So good. Like cookies and like, but I'm going to be a good girl. I didn't eat too much for, you know, the normal. I didn't do a lot of candy snacking because my weakness is milk chocolate, like so many billions of people on the earth.
No, listen,
and there's a lot of it.
Again, every time you say that, it triggers me. And then I'm wondering how we're friends, but I can forgive, you know.
You don't like milk chocolate?
No, it's gross, but I live for dark chocolate.
Yeah, I like dark chocolate too. I mean, obviously, I like dark chocolate.
Okay, girl, you know you better.
In all its forms. Speaking of which, have you seen the new Alex Cross series?
No, but
on Amazon?
I know you have.
I'm watching it for the plot. That is Aldous Hodge, baby. Ooh, yes, yes. I've loved him since Leverage, though. I love that show, Leverage. So
I started watching it. I don't know what happened.
It's fun. It's like one of those USA shows that they used to have like that. And like, I started rewatching the one with my other boyfriend, Matt Bomer.
Right. You have so many boyfriends.
I have so many boyfriends. So many TV boyfriends. Well, I think we should get started.
Yeah.
This week is me.
It is you.
And now that we have done Thanksgiving and we're moving into Christmas in celebration of our pumpkin spice, naughty and nice series, I wanted to do something around Christmas, particularly food, because I'm greedy.
I love food so much. Okay. Sorry.
Yes. And I was thinking of like, I was watching something on TikTok and they were talking about, this guy was explaining like the history of like sweet potato pie. So I don't know if you know that sweet potato pie is a African Americans from the South and probably in the North now, and definitely in the North now, but its roots are in Southern cuisine. It is something that we love. And I grew up on sweet potato pie. It wasn't until I got older and I got pumpkin pie. I like them both now, but at first it took me a while to get used to pumpkin pie because you couldn't find sweet potato pie in the North easily.
That's true.
Unless you were in like Harlem or something. So, but I don't think a lot of people know about sweet potato pie, that that's a big thing. And there is a rap song from the 90s, I think, called like, give me a piece of that sweet potato pie. Talk about a girl's booty or a body or something. I don't know. I just know this guy. So fly, like a hot sweet potato pie. And it's like a West Coast song,
I
too.
I really love that that's how you're connecting this to culture. I really do genuinely love that.
Kendrick, K-Dot is bringing the West Coast sound into hip hop again. It's in the zeitgeist. He just dropped an album that's so good. You guys should definitely check it out. And so that sweet potato pie thing reminds me, because it's very West Coast. I think it's from like the 90s or something. But as a black person, I know exactly what he's talking about. But a white person or a non-black person might be like, what is sweet potato pie?
Sal could probably like sing the whole song. He knows everything. It's if
delicious.
It came out in the 90s, he knows the song.
Okay. So it got me thinking sweet potato pie. And then I started doing a little research and I thought, you know, because obviously this is Notorious Women. Some of the women are heroic. Some of them are horrific. So this is a heroic Notorious Woman. I'm going to cover it this week.
Okay.
Which it got me here because of sweet potato pie. So that's always a good thing.
I love that you're driven by the food.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I'm a greedy child.
Delicious.
Now, so my Notorious Woman this week is Abby Fisher.
Okay.
So let's get into it.
Yeah.
All right. Now, Abby Fisher was born Abby Clifton in South Carolina in June of 1831 to Andrew James, a white farmer, and Abby Clifton, an enslaved woman.
Okay.
And her mother's name is spelled with I-E at the end, and hers is with a Y.
Okay.
So now several sources note that some say that she was born into slavery, but because of the nature of how slavery, enslaved people were listed on the slave schedules, and that's what they used to be called, that may or may not be true, but if she was in the South and she was black, she probably was enslaved. But so just take that with a grain of salt that has not been thoroughly proven to be true. So now what we do know of her is that after the end of slavery and after emancipation can be gleaned from census records. That's why census records are very, very important.
Yes, they are.
So in 1870, after emancipation, we get a clearer vision of like her movements and that kind of thing. So according to these records, in 1859, she was married to a man by the name of Alexander Fisher.
Okay. So now, she's still in the South, a black woman. We don't know if she's enslaved, even though her mother is enslaved.
Yeah.
And so she stayed with them. She was never sold.
So, well, I think I'm going to get into that in a little bit. So, again, because it's not very clear sometimes. And then back then, I don't know if you've done Ancestry or 23andMe, but
no.
Even in your own family things, like they'll misspell people's names. This is for everybody because the census taker, a lot of times, especially if they're talking to black people, are going by what they hear. So they'll write down what they hear.
Oh.
But oftentimes, and it depended on the literacy level of the census taker, which was probably white back then. So it just depended. But again, she and Alexander were married in 1859. So she would have been like
29.
Like she would have been 28. So again, and then the 1831 may or may not be true. So she would have been in her 20s. Now, in 1877, she and Alexander moved to San Francisco, where she taught Southern cooking to make a living and that kind of thing. So now I just want to put in context, after the end of the Civil War, those black people who had skills. So let's say if you had been skilled, trained as a blacksmith, your cooking, if you were known, if you were working in there in the kitchen with cook, you know, or whatever your specialty was, a lot of black people use that to then open up businesses.
Right.
Even though prior to that, it was illegal for them to be taught to read. So obviously illiteracy was huge among newly freed people because it was illegal to teach a black person how to read. So she probably was trained in a kitchen maybe on, probably if she was in the South, definitely on a plantation, whether she was free right. or enslaved. So as we know, the white people love collard greens. They love Southern cooking, just fried chicken, just as much as Black people, because yeah. it's delicious. and you know, the Black cook was in there cooking up some wonderful dishes. So. So she, that's probably where she got her training from. So she used that to make a living, you know, so okay, for yeah, her and her family.
That's fantastic.
Now from, her own accounts and one of her recipes from a book that she later wrote that I'm going to get into in just a minute. She mentions that she had had 11 children.
Wait a minute. What? Wow. Oh my God.
Some Ooh. Of them surviving childhood and some of them not. But some of her children included Benjamin, Eliza, Jane, Jenny, and Tilly.
Okay.
11 children Damn. By the time she was 40.
My vagina hurts.
This Ow. Is why birth control is important, people.
Yes.
Even for married women. So.
Yes.
Now, and it's also stated that we find out later that they moved from San Francisco. They moved to San Francisco from Alabama, which oh. we think that at some point she was born in South Carolina, but she actually grew up mostly in Alabama. So we don't okay. know if that's because she was sold at a young age and that's where she spent most of her childhood in Alabama, is where she met Alexander.
Is it wrong to venture a guess that there were not a lot of free Black people in Alabama?
Yeah, there are a few, but not. And if you were free, you always ran the risk of being
unfree.
Sold in. Yeah, exactly. Unfree. I love that. Yeah. So, but yeah, that's probably what happened. And I think also after the Civil War and after emancipation, a lot of Black people just wanted to move on.
Yeah.
They wanted to be like, that's in the past. And it's like, you know, now we know that you have to document this stuff. But even my grandmother who recently passed, I was trying to get her to talk about her childhood. Like, oh my God, what was it like in the, you know, in Northern yeah. Florida and when you were a kid? And she didn't want to talk about a lot of stuff. I was like, what were you doing during the war? Like, because my grandfather my great grandfather was in both world wars. He actually served
wow.
in one and two. So, and I was like, what was it like? Because obviously we know a lot of the men who were able were drafted and they went off yeah. to war. And I'm like, what were you doing? Because obviously she was a kid during the war and she didn't want to talk about it at all. But I'm like, that's so cool. Like, was it factory work? Like, she didn't want to talk about it at all. So I can only imagine
yeah.
if you were ever enslaved, you just don't want to talk about yeah. it. It's too yeah. painful too. So, but now they're in San Francisco. And when they moved to San Francisco, she became known as a fabulous cook, caterer. And they opened up probably a makeshift sort of like catering business and also a restaurant at some point. Because she was also known for her pickles and sauces.
Oh, not this just, woman. Yes.
Yeah. So it's like, obviously pickles and sauces, you can sell that a little bit more. But any way to make a living, right? Because again, right. both she and Alexander were not taught to read as children. Yeah. So they're making their way in the world as grown ass people, trying to make a living and starting right. their own businesses. So now she was so successful that eventually they would go on to build a culinary empire on a small scale, but in a way, right? Okay. Now, Alexander, the records show that so after Civil War, they, you know, they're free, but it's like, again, now we have to figure out a way to make a living and we don't want to become right. Tenant farmers. We want to because that's that's like a cyclical, you're never going to get anywhere that way, right? Sharecropping, basically.
Yeah.
So they started businesses and used their talents. So apparently Alexander became a preacher.
What? Okay.
Which was very common for yeah. former enslaved men. And he ended up in Florida at some point you know, but because of their involvement in the church and their ability to start a business, they became part of like well-respected
okay.
part of the Black community. And both okay. of them were very light-skinned. So if she's biracial, mulatto is what they would call him back then. He was also very light-skinned, so he may or may not be biracial, but you just never know. But they were both lighter-skinned people. Now, at some point, Alexander moved to Florida and become a preacher. And so that it seems like that was one of the reasons and ways that they were able to move out to San Francisco. He was coming out to be the pastor of one of the churches. But even in Alabama and Florida, they had been well off before. Considerably well off considering the other black people, because they had owned a home.
Ooh.
They had bought a home. So they sold their home, and with the promise of a new preaching job in San Francisco, they had money to actually get on, get a train ticket and come out west.
So, I was going to say, like, that's really expensive. Like, that's most, at that time, most black people probably couldn't do that.
Right.
They just, they... So that's,
or you'd have to do like the wagon train, like the cheaper route, but like
dangerous. There's so many ways to die on that wagon train.
Yeah. You know? So they had some means, right? They were not like, you know. And I will say that being lighter skin, even during enslavement, were, because oftentimes they were the offspring of rape between the owner. Mm-hmm. The plantation owner and the black woman, and some white men would give preferential treatment to their offspring, whether their white wives liked it or not, by teaching them trades, by teaching them blacksmith and that kind of thing, and showing some preferential treatment. It didn't always happen that way. If anything, sometimes the lighter skinned kids, I feel like, would get the brunt of the ire of the wife, who realized that they were the child. And so they would be even harder on the children and the slave woman who was raped. So it didn't always fall out that way. But I will say light skin privilege, it does exist, because even outside of that environment, other white people felt more comfortable with lighter skinned black people. So, and I mean, colorism is a real thing. So, but that's not to say that light skinned people always had it easy either, because I know they're very sensitive about that. And we are acknowledging that. It doesn't mean that dark skinned people had it easy. Let's like, yeah. But because I think, and then they present it a certain way, like, you know, so it's even if they were not literate. So that could have contributed, but it doesn't mean that they did not work their asses off to do with what they had, the little bit of experience or training that they had, to make the most of their lives. And again, these people were enslaved, and that is never an experience ever for a black person or a biracial person.
Yeah. So, just to be clear, this podcast does not support slavery. It seems to be coming into like vogue a little bit again. Okay. So like, no. Slavery is bad, and any like thing that allows for slavery, we're like also bad. So just, you know, just a heads up.
So cool. This podcast, slavery and Nazis are still bad.
Still bad.
All right.
That's on our like X'd out list of things we don't like. Okay.
Yeah. It's up there with rape.
It's up there with rape. Yes, yeah, just also
in case, in case it's not clear,
right?
It's up there. So
yeah, we don't like any of those things.
That. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you cleared that up, Miriam.
You're welcome.
Now in San Francisco, like I said, she became known as a fabulous cook, and they opened up a small business. He joined a church, but apparently there was like a little scuffle with the church elders. Like, he became a church elder, but with the church administration, there's like a disagreement. They said he was a terrible pastor. He lied on his resume, and then he accused them of being like morally bankrupt.
Okay.
Basically, like, they had a bunch of, he accused them of having side chicks.
Ooh, like, they probably did. Leadership. I'm just saying. Okay. All right. Mean,
it's California just, is where the gold rush and the prostitution was legal.
So. Listen, San Francisco, free love. I know we're like about 100 years away, but still. Okay.
Yeah. So it's hard to tell, but he actually sued them for his wages. He sued them for like $700. He eventually got like 100 and something, but they went back and forth accusing each other of what have you. But he, Alexander, was also enterprising, because he, at various points, he worked for politicians in the area, and he worked as a Pullman porter. which was a great job for black men. Like, it was definitely considered like on the high end for black jobs that black men could get. So he was enterprising too. And then they had the business, the pickle and the sauces, and then the cooking, catering, that kind of thing. So they basically turned into well-off Negroes. And keep in mind, this is Gilded Age America. So money is everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah. So again, their pickle business did extremely well. So well, in fact, that she was encouraged by some in the San Francisco upper crust people who liked her things to write down her recipes and put them in a cookbook.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because she's also bringing Southern cooking to the people. And Southern cooking, soul food, a.k.a. soul food, from her, it's just delicious. And it's comforting.
It's so good.
It's so good. So, and it seems like a lot of her clientele were probably white women, upper, well-off white women, middle-class white women who no longer, they had servants, but they no longer had like cheap free labor from slaves. Mm. And California was a free state anyway. But prior to that, but this is, so the fact that this woman could cook so well and she put down, actually wrote it down in recipes that they could follow or have their maid follow.
Right, right.
This was something that they really, really wanted to do. So she wrote this book with the help of obviously people who writing down these recipes for her, because she kept all this in her head, obviously.
Couldn't write it down.
Or maybe had other people write down versions of it, but most of it was kept in her head. So that's exactly what happened. She published a cookbook in 1881, and it's called, quote, What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Southern Cooking, end quote.
Oh, my God. I love the title.
Yep. It's a first-person account and historical document of Southern cooking in the pre-emancipation Carolinas area. Because, again, in Alabama area. So she's writing all of these recipes of pre-emancipation.
Right.
So this book, copies of this book is held at the Library of Congress, National Museum of African American History and Culture, and in several archives and private libraries.
That is so cool. I want to see this book.
Yeah. And you can actually get copies of it online. So you can download copies of it. Yeah, because it's obviously it was published in 1881. So it's in the public domain at this point.
Okay.
So
because I want to try some recipes.
Mm. Yeah. What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Southern Cooking. Now, so the book had only one edition, as far as we know, and it was heavily publicized in the local newspapers.
Okay.
And it was sold at grocery stores, and it flew off the shelves. It apparently was a big, big hit.
Nice.
But after a while, because it only had one edition, people forgot about it, right? Because it's 1881. Right. Now, but in 1984, whoa, so about 100 years later, food historian... Karen Hess rediscovered the book and researched this author, Abby Fisher, which is why we know about these little things that we actually do know about Abby Fisher, is because of the work that Karen Hess did. Karen Hess is also a food historian. She loves Southern cooking. So she was one of the first historians to make Southern cooking like part of academia.
I love that.
And especially black chefs and black cooks. And beginning in 1984, again, she documented it and resurfaced and found all this information about Abby Fisher and brought Abby Fisher to national light once again. But again, she could not find documentation about the actual enslavement of Abby, but she did find documentation that she did work as a plantation cook in Orangeburg, South Carolina.
Okay.
At some point. So, okay. Which is where she was born. And then again, like once you go through the archives, you have to piece together a lot of this stuff. So
she was in South Carolina for maybe a little longer and then went to Alabama.
Yeah, and then went to Alabama. Yeah. But that's why we know where she was born. And then she moved to Alabama and then to San Francisco because of the work of Karen Hess.
Thank you, Karen.
So thank you for historians. Thank you.
Yeah.
Now, in the 1880 census, Abby Fisher is listed with Alexander, her husband. Now, his profession is listed as pickle and preserves manufacturer. However, the business was under her name as Mrs. Abby Fisher & Co.
Okay.
So it's one of those things, is sexism. Her husband has to be mentioned and that kind of thing. But the business, I think, is interesting that it was under her name.
I didn't know you could even do that.
You know, I mean, I'm thinking of Madam C.J. Walker, you know, in the 1912s, 1910s, that kind of thing. Because, again, it's cooking, because cooking is still associated with women.
Yeah.
You know, and home cooks and that kind of thing. So that's just smart. And it's her recipe. She's probably making this stuff, and he's doing maybe business and marketing, that kind of thing. Now, again, they were very, very successful. And actually, in the original publication, in the opening, in the beginning, Abby tells everyone that she was awarded a diploma at the Sacramento State Fair in 1879. And awarded two medals in 1880, the following year, a bronze for best pickles and sauces,
nice,
and a silver for best assortment of jellies and preserves at the San Francisco Mechanics Institute Fair. Yeah.
So that's
probably what led up to it. Like, she's on the, you know, she's in people's minds.
Yeah.
People love her food. And then she's winning these awards in white spaces, basically.
Yeah.
And again, they were considered a credit to their race, quote unquote. So the white people were like, probably like, oh my God. Like, and again, she said her lady friends, her older women friends convinced her to do this. So that is why she decided to do it. She says, quote, after due. So in the opening of the published book, What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Southern Cooking.
Yeah.
It contained, first of all, the book contained 160 authentic old recipes, Southern recipes.
That's a lot. Including
ones for soups, roast meats, rice dishes, which is big in the Carolinas because rice is indigenous to Africa.
Right.
And then brought to the Carolinas because the climate is conducive to creating rice, and desserts, including sweet potato pie.
I want to eat that right now.
It'd be a great gift.
Let me just tell you. Okay. I'm going to brag right now.
Okay.
Everybody. I'm talking to everybody. I made for Thanksgiving two from scratch pumpkin pies.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And they were so good. Now I was going to make the whipped cream to go with it. Yeah. But Ralph's ran out of heavy cream. I'll say the name of the supermarket again if they want to sponsor us.
Just get Cool Whip, girl.
No, I know. My mom had...
You're such a domestic lady. I mean, you watch baking shows, so.
Yes, and honestly, whipped cream.
So you're going to like what's coming up. So, yeah.
Did I mention I baked them from scratch? Okay,
yes,
sorry. Go on. This is not about me. Okay. Sorry.
Now, again, in the opening, she talks about her medals and that kind of things, which I think led up to people wanting to publish this. But she states in the book, quote, after due consideration and encouragement and encouraged by my lady friends and patrons, she agreed to put the recipes down in writing.
Okay.
She mentions also in this in the opening statement that, quote, that she has been, quote, upwards of 35 years in the art of cooking, end quote.
Wow.
And she was a natural teacher. And she said that one of the reasons she wanted to write the book, other than her friends encouraging her, is to present, quote, a complete instructor so that a child can understand it and learn the art of cooking, end quote.
You know what's so sad is that probably every single one of those recipes, and I'm not a child, would take me at least 8 hours.
right.
I mean, the pies, like, for real, took me 2 days, but
yeah,
or it could have taken me 12 hours, but I divvied up the timing.
So
but,
she,
you know, I should look at them up and see what she thinks a child could do.
Yeah. And it's a child of like the 1880s,
right,
too.
They worked a lot harder than I've ever worked in my whole life. So.
Same. Yeah. Now, it's interesting to note that the book at the time cost around $40 in today's money. I mean, 160 recipes for $40, that's pretty good.
I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's a substantial present for someone for Christmas.
And also they said that one historian says that she thinks that the cookbook was targeted towards white women. So white, like I said, upper class women. So $40 is nothing.
They can pay for that.
Yeah.
Fine.
So because it's like, who is this for? It's not for black people, because black families probably already know, have their own versions of these recipes. So yeah,
they probably have a lot of judgment. They're like, oh, she puts corn flour in that. What I do, you know?
Yeah, totally. Like, there's this always a side thing of like what you put in your collard greens. Like, it's just so interesting. Now, side note, there was another book by a free woman of color by the name of Melinda Russell from Tennessee that had been discovered to predate Abby's book, cookbook. So that was discovered in 1995. They found like one copy, I believe, but it's so originally Abby Fisher's book was considered the first cookbook published by an African American in this country. But in 1995, they discovered Melinda Russell's cookbook. So,
okay, so you don't have to come at us. We know.
But it's just, but Abby Fisher's what Mrs. Fisher knows about Southern cooking. See, in my Southern accent comes out.
Yeah, there she is.
That that's the main one that people cite a lot of times because it was so extensive too, and it had a lot of push behind it. Like I said, after Hess got involved and started researching things, the book was republished and actually featured an introduction by Karen Hess as well. Now, the book in 1881 for Abby and Alexander went really, really well. It flew off the shelves. They sold it mainly in like grocery stores and that kind of thing.
Okay.
And Alexander was actually working for the mayor of San Francisco. And
he was fancy now. Okay.
I'm telling you, these are fancy, fancy kind of people. And he was also working as a Pullman porter at one point. So, you know, in addition to, I guess maybe after he had the fallout with the church.
Oh, yes.
You know, but I will say that one thing is to note that she and Alexander were well connected with with elite white people in the city. And that may have been the reason for the success of their companies and then the success of the cookbook as well.
Yeah.
Because they were just very well connected. And this is where the colorism advantage may or may not come in. That kind of thing as well. So, but that's just to know. It doesn't mean again that they did not work really hard, because apparently Alexander had like five jobs all the time. I don't know what he was doing.
It sounds like he's just doing he's just constantly busy doing something new.
Yeah, which is really, really smart and helping out with the business and that kind of thing. Yeah. So now from Hess's work on uncovering Abby's history, a whole new generation of chefs and authors found great inspiration from what Mrs. Fisher knows about Southern cooking. And it inspired a lot of chefs, including James Beard award-winning author Adrian Miller, who would go on to chronicle the evolution of many soul food staples such as sweet potato pie. In his book, Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate. Now, in his work, he went into some of our favorite dishes and Black Southern dishes, including sweet potato pie. And he talks specifically that sweet potatoes were introduced to West Africa around the 16th century. Okay. Now, the popularity of the sweet potato ultimately was found in the Black community in America due to convenience, because back in West Africa, which is a yam based culture, the sweet potato was considered, aka the white man's potato, the white man's yam. So in West Africa, they didn't really mess with it. They were like, that's the white man's yam. Yeah. But once enslaved people were on the other side of the Atlantic, they didn't have access to the yams that were native to West Africa. They were like, we'll try this. Yeah.
Little butter, little cinnamon, little nutmeg. Delish.
Exactly. Yeah. So he talks about, Miller talks about how enslaved people started roasting the sweet potato, and they cooked it in ambers, and then they started mashing it up and then adding spices like cinnamon and nutmeg. And then as they got more access to more cooking technology and equipment like ovens, they started to add the pie shells. And he talks about, he was like, if anybody's ever cooked a sweet potato from scratch, it is like you have to like work it. It's not an easy thing. So when you say that you cook something from scratch.
You know what? Actually, Lavetta, I'm really mad at you right now because I feel, because I did not carve up a pumpkin to make pumpkin pie. I took a can of pumpkin puree and opened it. Okay, fine. I'll admit it.
But you know what I did?
What
I went
did you
to
do?
A grocery store and bought a pumpkin pie.
See? So, I am better.
You are better. You are better. You are better.
But they're probably both about the same level of delicious, so I don't know who's actually better.
I don't know. Now, Miller goes on to say that during the Great Migration, an estimated 6 million Black families relocated to cities such as Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Detroit, and others. So much of the food culture was lost, but not with the sweet potato pie. Ooh. And I would say collard greens, too. Those two lasted. And they remained despite the work involved. With like back then, they actually, like you, Miriam, they would actually make these from scratch. Now...
Not exactly like me. I'll say it.
Now, he does say, unlike pumpkin pie, which can be made simply with the help of canned pumpkin puree.
That's right. That's right. Calling me out again. How many times are you going to call me out today?
We're not.
So many.
Now,
okay.
Sweet potato pie takes work.
Wow.
But he says that he thinks that one reason African Americans have chosen to stick with the beloved sweet potato pie is because, quote, it's just one of those foods that evokes deep, deep nostalgia for either family situations or communal situations.
But
it's
also,
a taste of
white
he goes
people
on to say,
are lazy. I'm just saying. It's fine.
He goes on to say that it's a taste of home. It's a taste of church. Aww. It's the taste of family reunions. You know, those settings where you can find a kind of escape from everything else that's happening in the world. You've got this bond. You're feeling the love, end quote.
Oh.
So that is why the sweet potato pie is so beloved in the Black community. Of course, haters are going to hate. So at some point... In like the 30s and the 40s, bigots would try and disparage that Black people love sweet potato pie. It's like, oh, sweet potato pie is for poor people versus pumpkin pie. And it's like, no, sweet potato pie is delicious. It kind of reminds me of like people online. Some podcasts are trying to say that bathing is what poor people do.
Yeah, that's a really good comparison. Yeah, like, oh, you bathe. Bleh.
You're not going to gaslight us into thinking that being dirty and filthy and not bathing more than once a week is for rich people. Why do you have showers in your house and these large marbled like showers, walk-in showers that are big enough for 10 people if you're not going to wash your ass?
Yeah, like daily.
I had to have one thing to say to these people. You nasty. Okay, wash your ass.
Yeah.
Now let's get back to sweet potato pie.
Listen, do you know the first time I had sweet potato pie was in my 20s? I didn't even
know.
Yeah.
Because they kind of look similar, so like when they're side by side, they look similar, but one's slightly darker, the color slightly darker.
I worked at a bakery in New York City, and they for Thanksgiving, they made everything, including sweet potato pie. And it was actually, I think, because it was really popular, because most places didn't make it, not unless it was in like Harlem, but they made it, and they made it good.
Yeah. Sweet potato pie is so good when it's done well. So now back to Mrs. Fisher's cookbook, what Mrs. Fisher knows about Southern cooking.
Okay.
Now, like I said, the book was extremely successful and it kicked off another phase of their of success in their family. So like for them, compared to other formerly enslaved people, they were doing really, really, really well.
Yeah.
So life went on as normal. And, you know, I'm sure they're very, very happy. They're able to, you know, have roofs over their head, feed their children, that kind of thing, and find success and go to fancy parties and concerts. But tragedy, like with all lives, happened because in 1886, so 5 years after the book's published, their daughter, Eliza Jane, who was just 17, passed away.
Ah. Why?
We don't really know. And also it seems like only four of their children moved with them to San Francisco. So it's we're not really sure what happened to the other children. We know that some of them didn't survive infancy.
Yeah.
But of the 11 children, only four of them made it out with them to San Francisco. And then one of them passed in 1886.
That's horrifying. That's
so you can only
sad.
Imagine. And she's in her Abby's in her 50s now.
Yeah.
So, and you lose your young girl who's on the cusp of adulthood. Now, perhaps it was this, the grieving or just the time. Who knows? But it did start to affect the business and the catering services and the manufacturing of pickles, even though this stuff continued. Yeah. But it just seemed to sort of like affect the family. And I'm sure it affected Abby and Alexander losing their little one. But they still were, they remain part of the notable colored people's sect, like, you know, and in 1891, so about 5 years after Eliza, Jane passed away, the family moved to the Noah Valley. And this seems to be a pretty, like a pretty well-off area. So again, they were still doing really well. Alexander retired from City Hall.
Okay.
And they continue with the business. But I would imagine that it's a personal tragedy for the family, and it's bittersweet in a lot of ways to lose your little one. Now, in the 1910 census, Jenny and Tilly were still living at home with their parents. And so, like I said, they from 1891, you know, up through the end of the end of the Gilded Age and, you know, into the new century, they were all living and working. Now, Abby died on January 9th, 1915 at age 87.
Well, she lived a nice long life.
Yeah, she was survived by Alexander, her husband, who had passed who passed 7 years later in 1922.
Wow.
And they were both buried with their children, Jenny and Tilly, at Cypress Lawn in unmarked graves. I don't know why. I don't. Yeah. Their son was buried a little bit ways away, but I don't know why they were more. And I guess that's why you need to have extended family around you, because
you need a also, cousin.
Having gone through this recently, like burying a beloved person in the family, a lot of family members do not step up.
Nope.
Like, they really don't step up and, like, getting, you know, burial thing. Like, they really don't. Like, they will drop the ball in a heartbeat. So if they have limited family out here and then that one or two people are not, like, I would imagine that their son, maybe he's married, but maybe they're not. I don't know. Like, but I don't know why these people who were, who seem to be pretty well off are marked, were in unmarked graves. Now, this was as of this, that reporting of the unmarked graves was about 3 years ago from some research I did. So hopefully since that time, people have actually, like
stepped
corrected
up.
That. Like, cause I know like Alice Walker did that for, Zora Neale Hurston.
Yeah.
Like Zora was found, you know, so she went and put a marker on her grave and that kind of thing. So for people, I think of unmarked graves for like paupers, right? Like, you know, people who don't have, like poor people basically.
Or like Mozart, you know.
Yeah. like Mozart. Like, or maybe they're trying to hide because they don't want it to be desecrated. But I can't imagine. I don't know why. I don't know. Maybe it was something of the time. Maybe it's just a cultural thing in America that people did.
Yeah,
maybe?
Well, I think you're right, actually. I think it's because culturally it's the family. We don't, as a society, work together how as a society, you know, we live with her, we are impacted by her, we work with her, we see her every day. Let us all make sure she has the proper send-off, right?
You definitely got to have family or friends around, and that's why you also got to write this stuff down. I know a lot of older people are afraid to do it because they think it's like it's an omen or something, but you got to write it down, because just having seen family members, like, no one thinks of like ordering flowers or like they like, and if the people are grieving going through that, like, it's real, and it happens so quick a lot of times. So, and I don't know what the embalming like practices were then. And then they're Black people, even though they're in California, they're still Black people. So, but I mean, overall, I think considering that you were probably born in enslavement and then went on as an adult and enjoyed a life that was full of hard work, but of success.
Yeah. And joy.
That you can buy your own house and, you know, which many, many people, no matter what their race, could not afford to do that. And then come out to, I'm so happy for them that they got to see like California, like the West, like a different kind of life versus just being in the Southeast also. Like, You know, because I think at that time, California was probably a better place to go than New York, even because New York is just so crowded.
Yeah.
Had the tenements. And
It was, it was more free, I think, because there's just more space.
Yeah. You know? And it's probably cleaner. Like just, And
I don't
like,
think anything could, was clean back then, but you know, maybe.
I'm thinking of New York City, London. Oh, yeah. I'm thinking of like dirty, like crowded cities. But that is Abby Fisher. Basically, she's like the mother of the sweet potato pie recipe, even though she's not the first to do it. But
listen, I love her. Thank you so much for bringing her. This was inspiring.
My pleasure. Like,
and,
get us
you know,
in the
I'm
mood.
I'm hungry now, so.
I know. And I haven't eaten lunch, so I'm really
Neither.
It's like, I need to go and like have something because now I want sweet potato pie or pumpkin pie. Like
I have some leftover pumpkin pie, but you know, the pumpkin was from a can. So was it homemade? I don't even know. Okay.
Miriam, again.
What?
You actually made a pie. I went to a store and bought a pie. And
you know where I get credit? I made the crust. That was from scratch, y'all.
How do you make crust?
Well, it takes a very special person to be able to do it. So, okay. I don't even know. I followed a recipe and prayed. I mean.
And on that note, actually, this would be, because you can find what Mrs. Fisher knows about Southern cooking. You can find it online now, and people should actually download the recipes
yes.
And try some of them.
Although sometimes old school recipes are like a hunk of lard. Mix it with, you know, like, and I'm like, oh, I don't. They don't even sell that. I mean,
Lord. Oh my God, that's hilarious.
You know, well, I'm just like, is there olive oil involved? How about farm fresh butter that I bought for $4? It's too expensive. You know what I mean?
Maybe somebody should do it on TikTok. I think this is like should do what Mrs. Fisher knows about Southern cooking recipes on TikTok.
Okay, y'all do that and tag us. Thank you. And then I'll try to do it too. But you have to do it first.
But if you want to be my best friend, make me a sweet potato pie and then mail it to me. Like,
wow. Yeah. I guess I don't want to be your best friend because that feels like a lot of work. I'm still tired from the pumpkin pies. Okay.
Now, you guys heard her. She does not want to be my best friend. So on that note,
okay, you know what? I'll bake you cookies.
I love cookies.
I will. I'll bake you cookies.
We will do that. So
okay.
Now that we've settled that, that wraps it up for the latest episode of the Notorious Women Podcast. Guys, remember to follow us on all the things.
Yeah, you do.
Also, copy the link, send it to your friend. And if you want to support the show financially, you want to give us some money, some moolah, you can do that at patreon.com/notoriouswomen. That's patreon.com/notoriouswomen. And Miriam, how else can they support and find the show?
You can find us on Instagram, Notorious Women Podcast. It's a good time. Some of the stuff I post is funny. Sometimes, you know, we're angry. That's fine. But, you know, that's fine. Who isn't these days? It's fine. TikTok, Notorious Women Podcast. You can email us at notoriouswmpod@gmail.com. If you have longer things, if you want to just DM us on Instagram, you can do that. You can also listen to episodes on YouTube. Just a reminder. You can follow us there. And that is that.
And we're on Blue Sky. That's a new thing.
Oh, right. I forgot about Blue Sky.
Yeah.
But we're on Blue Sky. It's Notorious Women.
Yeah.
At bluesky.social. Something like that. Y'all go to Blue Sky, look up Notorious Women. That's us.
That is us. Yay. And guys, we hope you're enjoying some of the leftovers or, you know, or fasting for the next cycle of food. So, and guys, we will see you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.